From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This is not the morning after. It's too late now to console half the nation about the decision the other half made. Also, there's no point this week in excoriating the press yet again for its many lapses this election season.
Because this week, the media have been very busy excoriating themselves. Not for failing to say early enough and loud enough that the aspiring emperor had no clothes, but for failing to project last year's punchline as this year's president-elect. So, as the duly appointed spokesperson for the entire American media, all I can say is, oops.
We're all sitting here sort of silence. In shock.
Pollsters missed it. Correspondents missed it.
We all missed the biggest political story of our lifetimes.
And I think we all thought it couldn't happen.
It was an upset, all right, in all senses of the word, due to the fact that the electorate was whiter, older, more rural, and far angrier at the powers that be than pollsters and pundits had anticipated. That much is clear.
What's a little less clear is why those voters came out for Trump in districts that had previously polled Democratic. And in that, the results served as a kind of Rorschach test for talking heads. Because when seeking answers, all of us, even journalists and pundits, tend to start searching in territory we already know, like racism.
This was a white lash against a changing country. It was a white lash against a black president, in part. And that's the part where the pain comes.
Sexism.
There probably is a strong sentiment about not having a woman president. And the fact that we're seeing this, particularly among non-college educated white men, is not surprising.
Or America's Whitman Sampler of woes.
Voters think Donald Trump can fix three things, you guys: terrorism, immigration, and trade.
The weird thing is, the mainstream media, not known for issuing mea culpas, actually are being a little hard on themselves. News outlets have been beating their breasts about missing the story, but in fact, they mostly didn't. For instance, here's CBS Sunday Morning.
Trump voters have had enough of holding their nose.
I mean, I'm mad. I've been mad. I'm one of the angry, you know, voters that they've been discussing for the last year.
And NPR.
44-year-old Jim Bell works in nearby Dearborn. He's a Ford employee represented by the United Auto Workers Union.
However, I leaned more towards Trump just because the change that Obama wanted to bring, I think Trump will.
Bell does like what the billionaire candidate says about trade, including that American factories will come roaring back.
And Fox News.
On the one hand, you have declining manufacturing jobs and other blue-collar industries in a very heavily blue-collar area. But on the other hand, you have the things that move in when these jobs go away. So you have rising mortality rates, rising heroin epidemic, and even, you know, rising family breakdown rates. And so for the folks who grow up in these areas, what they've seen, frankly, is a community, a neighborhood, struggling in a lot of different ways. And they've seen a Republican Party and a Democratic Party that hasn't really responded.
I think the media is blaming itself too much.
Chris Arnotti, a photographer and writer who logged 100,000 miles this election season talking to Trump supporters, concedes that much of the media, gripped by the candidate's, let's say, quirks, came late to this narrative, that in fact they should have been covering this slice of the electorate for decades. But Arnotti also concedes that the death of newspapers and the consequent lack of local reporting made that inevitable.
I think the idea that the media saw it but didn't believe it is a much stronger argument than the media didn't see it. I don't want to beat up on the media. Readers and editors and even writers of these pieces suffer from biases that they don't want to admit because it's uncomfortable. I certainly suffered from that in the sense I didn't want to see Trump win. I think if I had less of a bias personally about wanting to see Hillary win, I would have been more open. All the chips were there for me to see that Trump would win. All the pieces were there. I spent time in the states he flipped. I spent time in Pennsylvania. I spent time in Ohio. I spent time in Wisconsin. I saw plenty of people who voted for Obama who were voting for Trump. So I saw it. And it should have been pretty easy for me to then make the next intellectual step.
So the allegation goes, we media elites and our like-minded readers suffered a collective delusion. Well, if so, why? Here's the conventional wisdom expressed by the conventionally wise Tom Brokaw.
I do think that Washington and even those of us in the national media have walled ourselves off far too much from where people live.
And that is certainly undeniable. But it's not the only reason, because those cozy cocoons that the media and the rest of us nestle in don't exist only on the coasts.
They exist in our heads. We're literally wired to believe what we want to believe and ignore what we don't. I was thinking of a piece I did some years back called Your Brain on Politics. Here's a little piece of that. Emory University professor Drew Weston is the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. In a 2006 fMRI study, he used brain scans to see what happens inside a voter's head when confronted with candidates' statements that showed lying or pandering. The volunteers in the study had no trouble reasoning when dealing with the incriminating statements of the opposing candidate, but when they confronted hypocrisy from their own candidate, they were lost in space.
The first thing that was activated were a series of negative emotion circuits that were basically, for any of your listeners who can remember Lost in Space, it was Will Robinson, danger, danger. They saw danger, they saw threat, and you could see it all over their brains. Then what you saw was activation in a part of the brain called the anterior cingulate. It monitors and deals with conflict. So you could see that they were in conflict. They were trying to figure out a way out of that conflict. And then you saw, after they had come to their conclusion that there was really no problem for their guy, what you saw was activation in parts of the brain that are very rich in the neurotransmitters that are involved in reward. These are the circuits in the brain that get activated when junkies get their fix.
You mean once they figured out how best to lie to themselves, they got a blast of oxytocin or something?
Very, very close. That's right. So they got this huge blast of dopamine, which is involved in reward.
In other words, the same thing you get when you take Coke.
That's exactly right. There was no reasoning at all going on.
Obviously, this wasn't just the media's problem. In fact, it seems to have affected the entire U.S. population. To think that the 19th century historian Thomas Carlyle called economics the dismal science, he clearly hadn't reckoned with biochemistry.
Coming up, what the numbers tell us about the state of the nation and what they don't.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Here's CNN's Jake Tapper.
If this night ends up being the way that Donald Trump and his advisors hope that it will be, boy, I mean, it's going to put the polling industry out of business. It's going to be the voter projection industry out of business.
Nate Silver is the editor-in-chief of 538, our partners in election coverage this season, and he was oracular in 2012, correctly forecasting outcomes in all 50 states. Maybe that wasn't such a good thing in the long run, encouraging us, especially us journalists, to believe so much, so hard, in the purity of poll numbers. Welcome back to OTM.
Oh, thank you.
You've said that basically this result was within the margin of normal polling errors. I would say then, probably, the problem lies with us, those of us who consume the polls every 4 years, like cocaine-laced M&Ms.
Yeah.
But even you, at 3 a.m. on Wednesday, wrote that you were shocked by the result, but not surprised. So why shocked and why not surprised?
I mean, shocking because of the entire trajectory that American politics has taken over the past almost 2 years now since Donald Trump descended the elevator at Trump Tower. I think, naively thought that a candidate who made those sorts of appeals that were often based on populism and nationalism and racial appeals, you know, I thought that was not something that a sophisticated country like ours would go for in large enough numbers for him to win the primary, let alone become president. Narrowly, though, polls showed a competitive race and weakness for Clinton in the Electoral College. That's why we gave Trump about a 30% chance. Did I deep in the back of my head think, oh, Trump can really win? I mean, I think I convinced myself that it was possible based on having had this experience in the primary. I mean, that's what surprised me. I've never gotten so much pushback from the side of the candidate we had favored because we didn't have her favored enough. In retrospect, that seems like a real sign of complacency.
I don't know if I'd call it complacency. I'd call it denial, the same thing that was going on in your head so you could hold both shock and lack of surprise in your mind at the same time. I'm just wondering what went wrong outside of the heads of journalists. For one thing, you've said the state polls were especially bad this year. Why?
I think the state polls missed the extent to which polarization along partisan and particularly regional lines was to take place. It was just more polarized. Even within the five boroughs of New York, Clinton beat Trump by a record margin in Manhattan, whereas Trump won in a landslide on Staten Island.
So you guys have suggested there were fewer good polls this election cycle. Remind us why that is.
Polling is expensive. And the key driver of expense is how long it takes you to reach a respondent. So if you call and they answer your call on the first try, that's pretty cheap. If you need to call 10 people, then you're spending substantially more time. And the big expense in polling is the labor of people who are making phone calls. If you're only reaching 8 or 10% of the population, you have to be pretty lucky for the people who respond to be representative of those who don't. And I think what pollsters tend to do is they kind of assume that things are going to be like they've always been. And therefore, in an election like 2012, where the map changes very little from 2008, the polls can seem to be uncannily accurate, but an election like this one, where you see the coalitions shifting, I mean, it looks like Clinton may have come closer to beating Trump in Texas than in Ohio.
It's so bizarre. There's also the element of, you know, what you and many other people who study the numbers call bad polls. These are partisan polls. Online polls, which are still unproven. And yet, many were more reflective of the actual outcome than polls that use proven methodology. Were they not actually bad polls, or did they just get lucky?
First of all, the online polls, some of them did a little bit better. SurveyMonkey, for example, put out polls in all 50 states that show some things people criticized them for. They showed Michigan and Wisconsin close, but also Arizona and Georgia close. That's actually kind of in the right direction, at least. And in some sense, I think we have to root for online polls because the fact is that response rates to telephone polls are going to keep going lower and lower. And to have good instead of bad online polls means we'll have something to wrap our heads around. There are also cheap automated telephone polls where they just kind of use an auto dialer and kind of spam people.
Yeah, I always hang up on those.
Yeah. Ironically, those did well. Typically, those polls have a Republican bias. They'll overrate Republicans because they're only calling landlines.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, I think that Republican bias kind of canceled out the Clinton bias in other polls. And so they kind of wound up being right for the wrong reason.
Your model gave some polls more weight than others, and it considers the economy and history. Given what happened, do you think you may have to do a little recalibration on your model, you know, tinker with the secret sauce?
No. Because our model did a really good job of understanding the risks in a way that other models didn't. And it did for the reasons that Clinton lost, which is that it recognized that there was a pretty big chance of a split between the popular vote and the Electoral College, it recognized that states are correlated. So when you have the polls go bad in one state, say Michigan, there's a chance that similar states like Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, Clinton would lose as well. I mean, look, there was no way to look at the polls and to say Trump was a favorite. He wasn't. But to have had a model that was smart, quote unquote, enough to say, you know what, this is a much more competitive race than it might appear, and that Trump has a 30% chance despite trailing in all these polls, to me that reflects a well-designed forecast.
But while every forecast offers probabilities and not precise predictions, the message from the polling industry was pretty clear. Hillary Clinton was the heavy favorite, which brings us back to the Tapper quote I started with, if Trump wins, it's going to put the polling industry out of business. What do you think?
I mean, this is what's frustrating, is that there have been high-profile polling errors in Brexit and so forth. And, you know, what people have to realize is that if you have a bunch of data points that all say the same thing, they're all going to be wrong together, potentially, right? So the fact that there are 100 polls showing Clinton with a 3-point lead, it's still just a 3-point lead. To me, it's a miracle that the polls aren't off by more, you know? And I bet if you had surveyed members of the Washington, D.C. press corps and people who cover the campaign, they would have made Clinton a much heavier favorite than 70-30.
Yes, because they're just human beings. And
I know, but this is
cloistered in their little coastal environments.
And we are too.
But we want to trust the numbers, and this shakes our trust, no?
The purpose of a model or a forecast or a journalist is to do two things, right? Which is to say, here is the evidence, and here is why the evidence might be wrong. 538, I think, was one of the only sites out there who were saying, here's the polls. Yes, Clinton's ahead. Here's why they might be wrong. And if they're wrong only a little bit, Trump can win the election. If people aren't being careful about understanding that a 3-point race is a close race, then they're getting bad information. To me, it's a little bit bizarre for people to be blaming the polls when, number one, at least our analysis of the polls suggested that Clinton's lead was not safe, but more broadly, when the conventional wisdom was way worse and was way more dismissive of any chance that Trump had. People should check their own assumptions and the way they covered the campaign. Even if you're not making predictions, you know, you can see which reporters thought Trump actually had a chance and which reporters thought Trump was kind of a joke that would expire at 9 p.m. or so on November 8th.
Nate Silver is the editor-in-chief of 538, our partner during this election season. Nate, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The most recent gross domestic product figures came out in late October, a couple of weeks before the election, and they were pretty good. The headlines blared yet another repudiation of a Donald Trump claim.
The economy growing 2.9% last quarter, beating expectations. And up till now, the Trump campaign has been all about how bad the economy is.
If only his followers could see that latest report, perhaps they'd realize how great their finances were. One Politico headline even read, quote, "Strong economic news undercuts Trump's doom and gloom message." Except, not necessarily, because economic indicators like the GDP are not meant to and certainly do not reflect the finances, buying power, standard of living, or prospects of individual citizens.
We create this one number, and then there are 320 million people.
Zachary Carabel is the author of The Leading Indicators, A Short History of the Numbers That Rule Our World.
Primarily, GDP is our output. It's our economic product collectively as a country. So there's a GDP growth figure, i.e., how much did GDP grow? And then there's an actual number of $17, $18 trillion for the United States. We then just take 320 million people and divide them into whatever that number is. That's statistically true, but it's also kind of meaningless. There's an old canard that if Bill Gates walks into a bar, everybody in that room is instantly, per capita, a multimillionaire. And that is why GDP can go up or down, and that doesn't really tell you whether or not the prospects of vast numbers of individuals are going up or down with it.
Another big economic indicator, and often a misleading one, is the jobs report.
In front of supporters at a New Hampshire country club, Donald Trump slammed the latest government jobs report.
These numbers are an absolute disaster.
The numbers show unemployment down and wages up, but Trump called them phony.
So much like GDP, the unemployment rate and the jobs report are products of the Great Depression. In the early 1930s, there were clearly a lot of people suffering, but we had no idea how many people were employed or unemployed. We didn't even really know how to define what unemployment was. I mean, we think it's obvious, but it's not. Just not having a job doesn't mean actually statistically that you're unemployed. You have to not have a job and want to have a job. You have to not have a job and have looked for a job. So anyway, we invented this category of life called unemployment. And like GDP, we created one national number. But that national number, like GDP, is a big average and tells you nothing about local realities, tells you nothing about class realities or education realities. Now, all of those things are released by the government in reams and reams of tables and charts. We just pay attention to this headline number.
Okay, you can have a job, but it's at Arby's for $9 an hour, which is not the same as a job at some tech firm for $75 an hour.
Right. And for the jobs report, when it's released, a job is a job is a job. We have other reports that deal with that, but when we talk about the unemployment rate and the jobs report, all jobs are equal. Frankly, many of the jobs that have been created over the past 7 or 8 years are mediocre jobs. I don't mean that they're occupied by mediocre people. I mean the pay level, and let's not even get started on benefits, which are often non-existent, simply doesn't get you there. So you can have a good unemployment report and a lot of legitimately unsatisfied, anxious people who are fully employed.
Another big issue in the election campaign was trade.
And they're killing us in trade. They're killing us.
And I guess the big indicator there is the trade deficit.
Yeah, I think trade statistics are probably the most antiquated of our numbers relative to how things are actually traded in the world today. So all of our trade numbers assume that everything you buy, take an iPhone, has one country of origin. And in the case of an iPhone, it's made in China and sold in the United States. So every time an iPhone gets bought in the United States, it adds $200 to the trade deficit with China, i.e., it shows up as a negative. We just don't have the tools, really, to measure the world of trade as it actually is. And so we're left with this optic of we're sending all this money to these other countries, and it's just neither so simple nor is that really accurate.
So much was made by Donald Trump about making America great again, hearkening back to some possibly non-existent halcyon times. But if he was talking about the post-war period, when our economic growth was so remarkable, when our standard of living so dramatically increased, my argument is that that was really a bubble economy, that it was just a moment in history when various trade barriers and tariff regimes still protected our markets, but our market was vastly bigger than any place else in the world. So we sold so much to ourselves. And our manufacturing economy was so sophisticated that the whole world was our customer. Globalism really didn't exist. And it was a bubble that simply burst. There was no government policy that could do anything about it. Am I nuts?
No. And in addition, which you didn't mention, there was a period of time from the end of World War II through the 1960s where the United States was 50% of all global manufacturing because everybody else who had been making stuff like Japan and Western Europe had been decimated by the war. Factories destroyed, populations dislocated. So when you're that proportion of the entire planet's output, you're going to do really well. The problem is we started to think of that as normal. That was abnormal. This is normal. There has been a lot of prosperity created globally over the past 20 years. Admittedly, much of that has gone to hundreds of millions of emerging middle class elsewhere and not in the United States. And we have been challenged by those trends. However, simply rejecting those trends does not magically make us more prosperous. A, we're not going to take jobs back from robots, and B, we need to address cost of living and wages, and we're not going to get that by taking it from others. So, you know, we have a lot of challenges.
I want to play a famous piece of GDP tape, if there is such a thing. This is from just a few weeks before Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated in 1968. He was, at that point, the insurgent candidate who was seeking the Democratic nomination for the presidency. The gross domestic product, he said, counted air pollution and jails and napalm and violent television programs, not, you know, just steel output. Yet
the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials.
It was a great speech, and it was the beginning, I think, of a recognition that, look, there's a whole lot of our economic activity that we fail to capture. And there's some things that we do that are positive for our lives that are negative for our numbers. So we have to be careful about how much we correlate GDP growth and happiness, or people actually living stable, successful lives. And then there's the whole question about security, right? Are people secure in their economic outlook and in their future? And certainly one of the things this election has shown is that feeling of not just do I have enough, but will I have enough? Will there be enough for my children, is an absolutely key component to how people feel about their country and their future. And none of our numbers can really get to that.
If during the course of the election campaign, the media had access to better numbers, numbers that got more to our fears and anxieties and prospects than just a snapshot of the overall economy, do you think this could have had an effect on the rise of Trumpism and its narrative of economic doom?
So it's not like the data isn't out there. I think the reality is we are aware in broad terms that there are a huge number of people for whom the outlook is negative and getting worse, or certainly not getting better. And for a lot of people, the outlook is good and getting better. The question is, could you have united those two realities, right? You could have tailored messages better. You could have spoken to both better. Because clearly what you have now in our political life is one candidate's really good at speaking to one set of concerns or one economic reality, and another candidate's really good at speaking to another, and no one's particularly good at speaking to both. You know, could we do that? We certainly could do that. Will we do that? I guess we'll find out.
Zachary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Zachary Karabell is the author of The Leading Indicators, A Short History of the Numbers That Rule Our World.
Coming up, how unplugging the Electoral College would change election coverage.
This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For the second time already this century, our president-elect won the electoral vote without getting the most votes. Before the 2000 election, that had happened only three times, all in the 1800s. As of this writing, Hillary Clinton received hundreds of thousands more votes than Donald Trump overall. a fact which has prompted a familiar debate.
We got to get rid of the Electoral College. That would be a good thing to do in a constitutional convention. This is an absurdity held over from slavery.
A renewed push for it to change, especially among Democrats, because they've been burned by the Electoral College twice in the past 16 years.
More than two-thirds of Americans favor a popular vote over an electoral one, but the Electoral College system, in which a group of people cast votes for president on behalf of the people in their states, is enshrined in the Constitution, so abolishing it would be tough. There is, however, a way around it. States could choose to award their electoral votes to the candidates who got the most votes nationally, effectively making the Electoral College vote and popular vote one and the same. This is an effort called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But first, why does the Electoral College even exist?
Well, mainly because the framers of the Constitution couldn't agree on how the nation should choose the president. Should Congress make the pick, or should the population have a say? So they punted the responsibility down to the states, granting them a number of electoral votes and the freedom to decide how to cast them. For several years, states took different approaches, but eventually most settled on the one we know well, that the winning candidate in the state takes all the electoral votes. Rob Ritchie is the executive director of the nonpartisan organization Fair Vote and co-author of Every Vote Equal. He's an advocate for electoral reform, and he says that the idea that the Electoral College prevents smaller states from being dominated by bigger ones is all wrong.
Yeah, that's an argument tied to the math that the number of electors per capita is bigger if you're in a small state than in a big state. But the reality of what really gives your state power in the Electoral College really isn't that per capita number. It's whether your state is one that the candidates compete in and actively seek your votes. And that's actually not tied to that small state math.
That is interesting. In other words, the Electoral College has a huge impact insofar as it creates swing states.
Absolutely. And in fact, there's about 35 states which now for four consecutive elections have been completely outside of campaign attention, that really are just spectators to the presidential election. So we don't have a United States election for president. We have a swing state election for president from the perspective of the campaigns.
Right. Let me bring up the second defense of the Electoral College, and that is essentially the electors are there to protect us from ourselves.
Right. It's a funny argument in that it was used early on in the first few years, and then within 10 years of setting up the system, we had already gotten to this partisan reality where the electors were really expected to be rubber stamps for the people who wanted them to vote a certain way, right? So the idea of them as a deliberative body that would look at this winnowed field of candidates, choose someone, we just never did that. These days, if someone did that, they're called a faithless elector because they're being faithless to what they're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, Hillary Clinton has won the popular vote, and so we're seeing petitions to abolish the Electoral College. But as you say, it's baked into the Constitution, so that's not going to happen, right?
Well, we always could change the Constitution, and I'm not going to say that we can't. We have to have three-quarters of all states pass it, and that's a challenge.
So instead of trying to change the Constitution, you back the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. What is it?
So here's the most simple aspect of it. We want to have the White House go to the candidate who wins the most popular votes in all 50 states and D.C. So that's the goal, and that's what happens once this is in place. Now, here's what happens to make sure it gets into place. States keep their electoral votes, and they change the rule for governing how they award those electoral votes. So right now, most states give all their electoral votes to whoever wins the popular vote in their state. The new rule is they're going to give all their electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote in all 50 states and D.C. That's one change. The second part of it is they don't want to do it on their own because that conceivably could have partisan consequences. They want to make sure that they're doing it in a way that guarantees that the national popular vote winner is always going to win. So the Interstate Compact is an agreement to wait to enact it until the number of states that have passed it can make it decisive.
So basically, you need enough states to bring the total number of electoral votes to 270.
Exactly. Once it hits 270 in the next election, it becomes activated. So it's already passed in a number of states, but because it's not up to that 270 point, the current rules still govern what those states do. But once we hit 270, and we'll have a national popular vote guaranteed.
And it's been passed, I guess, in 10 states and D.C. How many electoral votes do you have so far?
That's 165 electoral votes in the participating states, so it's 105 electoral votes away.
Uh-huh.
And it's been introduced in all 50 states. It's passed state legislative chambers. And I think these kinds of debates that we're having right now about the system and how it's working for us are the kinds of ones that ultimately are going to get us across the finish line, because we want elections to be decisive, and the current system can create this argument that it's not fair. And, you know, I think we want to have a system that people believe is fair.
Aren't you essentially turning the Electoral College, without removing it, into a vestigial organ?
Well, in a certain sense, that happened 10 years into its existence. As soon as it no longer was a deliberative assembly that really picked people based on, you know, the elector's own judgment, and just became a rubber stamp, it really wasn't what the founders intended at that point, right? And people have wanted to have a popular vote for president for decades, and this is a way to get it to them.
Now, you've said this has strong bipartisan support, but aren't the vast majority of the states, if not all of them, blue?
In the wake of the 2000 election, there was a perception for many years that somehow this was a plan that would help Democrats, because Gore won the popular vote and Bush won the electoral vote. The rational fact that you could look at the 2004 election and say, oh, that's interesting, Bush won it, but if it had been a little closer, he would have still won the popular vote but lost the electoral vote. You can actually show the numbers sort of reveal that.
But that's not what happened.
It wasn't as visceral, right?
And this year, it's Hillary Clinton who's won the popular vote and lost the electoral college, which suggests that maybe the situation as it stands benefits Republicans.
If there had been a popular vote for president, they would have just run a very different campaign. The fact that they zeroed in on four states and both campaigns spent half of their campaign energy on those four states and Trump won them all is a suggestion that at least he would have had a real equal chance, I think, to win a popular vote if he'd been running for it. But you're right that there's that perception. But I wanted to say this about the nature of the bipartisan support. There has been more and more Republican support. Say when it passed New York State, the state Senate is run by Republicans. It passed the Arizona House this year with a Republican-run chamber, and it passed committees in Republican-run states like in Georgia and Missouri. So I'm hoping that this election actually doesn't divert attention from the core argument, which is that there's all these states that get left out, whether they're red or they're blue. Our hope is that the sort of partisan energy that's being created by what's happening right now doesn't actually interfere with the trajectory that I was seeing, which is that this national popular vote plan was heading toward likely implementation by 2020.
Tell me what the National Popular Vote Compact would have on the way we cover elections.
One of the things I like about elections is it's a chance for us as a people to get outside of some of the sort of the niche conversations we have and have more of a collective conversation. And I think when they are devoting so much of, you know, more than 90% of their actual time, but also the polling that governs what they stress is also pitched toward those 9, 10, 11 states, we're missing out on some of the really exciting things that are good about America that just happen to be associated with states that aren't swing states. You know, I think that there really would be sort of a different mix of stories. We would be hearing a little less about what the Ohio needs and interests are, and more about what all these other states' needs are as well.
I'm thinking of the iconic red-blue map. I think what you'd get is sort of violets and purples instead.
Exactly. The reddest areas still have some Democrats, and the bluest areas still have some Republicans. And that's also one thing I think which would be great is just an opportunity for those people, wherever they are, to feel connected to the choice of their leader.
Would you consider heading a movement for a national simultaneous primary day?
I am really intrigued by that proposal, but with one huge caveat, which is that we do it after we actually have all the state-by-state contests. actively, you know, doing caucuses and primaries in every state would winnowing the field. But rather than having those contests decide at all, you would actually then have everyone on an equal basis. You know, maybe you learn something new about a candidate and you regret the vote you cast earlier.
So leave the primary system in place, but then put another vote on top of it so you get a chance to change your mind.
That's what I would do. Come together on a common day, first Tuesday in June or something, and pick the nominee.
Okay, Rob Ritchie, what the heck are you going to do about gerrymandering?
Well, there's an answer to that one, too. It's to think outside the box. And if you think of the box, in this case, it's the fact of districting itself. Because as soon as you draw the district, it's going to help some people and hurt other people because it's winner-take-all. Erase some of those district lines. So let's go from, let's say, Massachusetts, which has 9 single-member districts, meaning one person represents each district across Massachusetts, and Democrats have won every single seat for more than 2 decades. You would then say, let's have 3 districts, each with 3. So that would be step one. You'd have fewer districts with more people. And then there's methods of voting, like the ranked choice voting system they just passed in Maine, which you
get to put your first choice and your second choice and your third choice and even your fourth choice.
Yeah, you get the freedom to do that. And when you do that, the way it works is that almost everyone in that district would help elect someone. And so the district lines would be less important than how you vote. And you wouldn't have monopoly representation. You would have a degree of proportional representation, and you would have this fairer balance of viewpoints represented across the country. And right now, you have all these sort of dead-end districts. 90% of districts, you can foretell the outcome 2 years before the election, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
If you do this, you'd actually have a competitive reason to vote in every election. The candidates would have real incentives to engage with voters across these districts, and we'd get a nicer mix of people. We'd have urban Republicans from Manhattan, and we'd have, you know, Oklahoma Democrats, which I think Congress really needs, so the parties just don't vote rubber stamp for their side.
I really appreciate your optimism. It makes me dream of solving other intractable problems. Like, do you have a way to make a workable jetpack?
Well, let's work on that one too now. But the fun part of this for us is these are all statutory. We can do this by a simple change in law. So it's really an act of our own political imagination that is within reach.
Rob, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Rob Ritchie is executive director of the nonpartisan group Fair Vote and co-author of Every Vote Equal.
On Sunday, September 2nd, 1666, Samuel Pepys took up his quill and scratched this entry in his diary.
Jane called us up about 3 in the morning to tell us of a great fire they saw in the city. So I rose and slipped on my nightgown and went to her window and thought it to be on the backside of Mark Lane at the farthest. But being unused to such fires as followed, I thought it far enough off, and so went to bed again and to sleep.
He went back to bed because it was a fire, no big deal. He had no idea that the orange glow he saw would become a defining event in history. The Great Fire of London raged for 3 days, destroying 70,000 of the city's 80,000 homes. James Fallows, national correspondent at The Atlantic, wanted to capture that moment of not knowing what would happen, even as the Trump campaign unfolded. So he began recording events in an ongoing feature he called The Time Capsule. There are 152 entries, including number 73, titled The Second Amendment People. Quote, "Today, August 9th, 2016, was the day the Republican standard bearer made a joke in public about his Democratic rival possibly being shot to death." And number 7, titled The Judge We Believe is Mexican, in which Trump questions the ability of an Indiana-born judge to adjudicate a case against him. And number 98, The Classified Briefing, in which Donald Trump characterized what he had heard from intelligence officials in a classified briefing. Documented by Fallows, why? Because it was, to say the least, outside the norm.
You should know that I'm marking this down as somebody who does not want Trump to become president, but I'm not marking it down to persuade anybody or to try to mobilize any votes, but rather to record for the long run what the United States knew about this man while deciding whether or not he would become our president as we have now decided.
Well, apart from everything else that the capsule represents, Jim, it's very convenient as a journalistic tool because instead of having to take every outrage as it crops up during the campaign and be freshly outraged and kind of gin up a premise for a story, you have this ongoing structure that you don't have to kind of justify as news value. It's kind of a neat journalistic trick, no?
In retrospect, that became apparent to me. When I started out doing this, I had no idea whether I'd just do it for a week or two or how long it would go on. But exactly what you're saying became evident to me that it was a way to record things that I wanted to say something about without having to get all worked up about them. Just say, okay, this happened today. This hasn't happened before in American history. And the one exception is in 1820. And that's why it was different in 1820. But it was the way I could journalistically come closest to encompassing what was of interest to me during the campaign in a structure that I hoped would be interesting to readers.
Start unpacking. What's in there?
These things fall into several categories. The one standard I wanted to set up at the beginning and continue all the way until episode 152, which was the last one 3 or 4 days ago, was to say these are things that are either unprecedented in a literal sense or just beyond the normal range of what we ask of or expect from presidents, or things that would have stopped previous nominees in their tracks. And an example, I can't remember which installment this was, when Donald Trump very early on made fun of John McCain as a loser for having been captured in Vietnam, and Trump saying he prefers people who don't get captured. You know, that's the kind of thing that would have been a major flap for previous candidates, and Trump, as we know, just sort of rolled right through it. And so the idea was to avoid the dulling effect and the inuring through repetition to the things that Trump did and said, to try to record them real time. To give you an example of one very early one, when Trump went out to California, my home state, and announced to great fanfare there was no California drought. And this was all sort of a plot by environmentalists. If you know anything about California, the main fact of its existence in the past 5 years has been the historic and devastating drought. And so I just thought it's worth noting this is something a normal person would not say.
It seems like Trump put us through some sort of homeopathic therapy where he was playing with so many little bits of poison that he stopped being
he built up our immunity.
Yeah.
I think among the many postmortem exercises we'll all be going through is how it was that Donald Trump ended up getting a majority in the Electoral College, though not in the popular vote, doing dozens of things, any one of which could have and has stopped previous candidates. Whether it was the way that people in the press got used to it? Was it something about the fact, as we had an Atlantic article saying, that people who supported him took him seriously but not literally? They knew this was just kind of a performance like in pro wrestling.
In the coming days, we will see endless postmortems and endless wringing of hands over exit polling to find out where the pundits got it wrong, where the Democratic Party got it wrong, and so forth. But as you look at the items in your time capsule, is it your sense that this creates a template for future elections, or whether it is just kind of a one-off? You know, finally, the United States has found out that to one degree or another, it can happen here.
I think that these results could not have happened without the one-off, very idiosyncratic personal history and performance skills of Donald Trump, so it won't happen again in exactly this way. But like many people, I think I am much less confident or certain of the resilience and stability of our democratic checks and balances than I would have sounded a day or two ago.
So, Jim, to bring this around to where we began, when you first undertook this project, the idea was to collect the ephemera of an election so that at some point our future selves would be able to look back and see not only what took place, but what our reaction was to it. As we speak, it's the day after the election. I'm wondering if you believe now that the time capsule will have some sort of cultural, political, anthropological value.
I can't have any idea of whether anybody will ever look at this again in a month, in a year, in 10 years, but I wanted just to record rigorously in real time so that I wouldn't know when writing it whether this was the thing which knocked Trump off his game, whether we'd look back on this as a minor thing, whether we'd remember it at all, so that you had something that is almost impossible to get in any kind of historical writing or journalism of writing when you don't know how the story is going to turn out. There's an example I will use very cautiously, which is William Shirer's Berlin Diary. And I use it cautiously because I am explicitly not saying this is like the rise of the Nazis, but I am saying the historical value of that is what it was like day by day in the early 1930s in Berlin as things were changing. We know now how it turned out. He didn't know that when writing it. And I wanted also to record things when none of us knew what the end of the story was going to be, how it seemed, felt, and changed us in real time.
Are you going to continue the time capsule during the course of the Trump presidency?
I do not dare think that far ahead right now, 12 hours after the results have come in.
Jim, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bob.
James Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic.
We're aware that some of you may find this episode a little unsatisfying because we failed to give full expression to the anxiety twisting most of our listeners' entrails. Well, we do have something like that in the form of an editorial meeting recorded Wednesday morning called Now What? It's pretty much a primal scream. And you can find it at onthemedia.org. But the fact is, we have to move on, because next week and the one after that, we have to keep probing and exposing and monitoring this stress test of the American experiment. This is our reckoning. We've all got some work to do.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Paige Cowett. We had more help from Michael Loewinger, Sara Kari, and Leia Feder. And special thanks to Elliot Samuel Pepys Burgess. Our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter's WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.